You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. All About Eve by Brit Hinemuth, with photographs by Emma Summerton, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. World-class equestrian, model, and daughter of the late Apple legend Eve Jobs is off to the races. Opening photo, Free Spirit. Eve Jobs, photographed in Cold Spring, New York, in June. And in the photo, she's wearing a long flowing dress with water in the background, and she's running. In his best-selling biography, Steve Jobs, Walter Isaacson writes that the visionary's youngest daughter, Eve, is the apple that fell closest to the tree. A strong-willed, funny firecracker who used to call her father's assistant to make sure she was on his calendar. "I have zero recollection of that," Jobs tells me over lunch. "I'm so sorry to let you down there. I have a recollection of going to work with him and drawing on this one whiteboard in his office that I believe stands there to this day with all my little doodles on it. I would just subconsciously soak in all the beauty and gorgeous design around me. I note that there's an iPhone resting on the table between us and recording our interview. It's a beautiful reminder for me every day," she says, looking down at it fondly. "All day, every day, it really is. It makes me feel warm." Even if Jobs can't remember negotiating with her dad's assistant, I can attest that Isaacson got the strong-willed, funny firecracker part right. We'd first crossed paths at a cocktail party at Los Angeles' Academy Museum, during which she was quick-witted and wickedly observant, and grilled our table mates with questions. "I'm a little weird," Jobs says now. "Some people get a little taken aback by me. I don't know where to place her, but humor makes you feel like you were living. I tell her it's clear that she doesn't suffer fools. Sometimes one will slip through the cracks," she tells me, "but it's a rarity." The 24-year-old world-class equestrian and Stanford graduate traded Silicon Valley for New York City in the fall of 2021 after making her runway debut for Coperni in Paris. Jobs has since signed a deal to be a face of Louis Vuitton and will star in a digital campaign later this year. For our meeting, her agent has chosen a restaurant in Chelsea near the High Line. And Jobs arrives early in a crisp white smock and flowing trousers. The only sign that she's actually a 20-something are the Nike Jordan 1s on her feet. "I live in a very basketball-heavy household." Jobs is a self-proclaimed horse girl who used to bring carrots to her sister's barn and began taking proper pony lessons at the age of 6. Her parents encouraged her to prioritize school, but allowed her to travel for show jumping competitions during summers and spring breaks. "I wanted to see how far I could take this," Jobs says. "It's a hard sport to do, mostly because you only get 2 minutes in the ring, and you're working with something, an animal, that's inherently unreliable." She was in contention for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, but had to bow out after they were postponed a year because of COVID. "After graduating from Stanford," she says, "I was at this turning point. I had done everything I wanted to achieve in the sport, and I just felt at peace." Modeling, Jobs discovered quickly, is not entirely unlike show jumping. "It's all about turning it on for 2 minutes at a time. I was more grateful than nervous," she says. "I never foresaw modeling, and on a whim I was like, why not? It drew upon things I knew, igniting the part of me that competing always did." Jobs is well aware how charmed her life has been, Notwithstanding the untimely loss of her father to cancer when she was 13, she considers her mom, business executive and philanthropist Lorraine Powell Jobs, a guiding light. As my life unfolds a bit, I'm going to find my avenue to impact the most people in the best way possible, she says. I want to take my time and get it right and find something I love, just as I see my mom finding ways in which to reach people. With Fashion Week nearly upon us again, Jobs hopes to be walking many major catwalks. At home, meanwhile, she keeps things casual. She has started a collection of vintage Apple T-shirts, one of which holds tremendous personal value. It appears to be a one-of-a-kind prototype from the Computer One era, likely made by her dad when Apple was still based out of his garage. On the front, the T-shirt alludes to a certain biblical icon. Eve had the right idea, it reads. On the back, the text continues, she picked an apple. It means so much to me, Jobs says. I smile every time I wear it.
Thank you.
the Magic Mountain by Jennifer Gould. Herbalife founder Mark Hughes planned to build his dream mansion on a spectacular plot of L.A. real estate, but when he died of an overdose, it became ground zero in a legal war. Now his ex-wife is opening up about the battle over the billion-dollar property. Opening photo shows a beautiful piece of land with a winding road in the foreground. The city way in the background, and a beautiful expanse of sky. High above the lights of Los Angeles stands the mountain, impervious to the Hollywood power players and business tycoons plotting and scheming below. Many have coveted its 157 acres, but the mountain has remained tantalizingly out of reach. Spanning a surface area bigger than 100 football fields, this grassy, lush mountaintop has been the prize, once valued at $1 billion, of Middle Eastern royals, A-list stars, and mega moguls. Rihanna, Salma Hayek, James Cameron, Elon Musk, and others have made pilgrimages to the mountain for roving Oscar parties and charity balls. Yet the only creatures to make the mountain their home are the deer that frolic nearby. At other points, known as Tower Grove or the Vineyard, the Mountain of Beverly Hills is arguably the city's most spectacular undeveloped parcel of land. For the rare few who have owned it, the mountain has been both a blessing and a curse. The last Shah of Iran's sister once owned the mountain. She planned to build her brother a palace in exile until Molotov cocktail-hurling Iranian students changed her mind. Next came Merv Griffin, who set out to best Aaron Spelling by building the city's biggest mansion at its peak. Then he ran out of steam. In 1997, Griffin sold to Herbalife guru Mark Hughes for $8.5 million, setting a Southern California record at the time. Hughes planned to build his own dream house there, but his whole dream unraveled. 3 years after Hughes bought the plot, he was dead from an alcohol and antidepressant-fueled overdose. A reportedly $400 million estate, including the mountain, went to his only son, Alex, then 8 years old. And a brutal war ensued, pitting Alex and his mother, Susan Hughes, against the estate's three trustees, whose role was to protect the estate's assets until Alex turned 35. But as Susan levied in court, the trustees had plans of their own. Instead of acting like trustees, they wanted to be Mark Hughes and develop the mountain themselves, Susan told Vanity Fair. Launching numerous lawsuits, Susan alleged that the group made arbitrary and capricious decisions and were hostile to Alex. She also alleged that one of the trustees sexually harassed her and she wanted them removed. The trustees denied her accusations and Susan lost. She cast herself as a David against their Goliaths in a pre-hashtag MeToo world, one that negated her claims as a mother protecting her child, while the trustees retorted that she wanted to wrest control of the trust for her own benefit. The impression that everyone had on the trustee side was that Susan was litigating to take over the trust herself because she was the mother of the only child and heir, and therefore she should be the trustee, even though it was Mark's money and he was entitled to choose who he wanted to manage it for Alex's benefit. Even if Mark did not have great insight into the people he was naming and they ultimately abused the trust, an attorney who once worked for the trustees told Vanity Fair, "Never did I have the impression that they were managing this estate because they cared about Alex." The trustees consulted a psychiatrist and a rabbi about the potentially harmful impact of wealth on a child. As the trustees' then-lawyer, Edward A. Woods, said in a 2005 interview with the Los Angeles Times, Does he need a chandelier, or would he be content with something from IKEA? Any kid would be fine with IKEA, but Alex had been raised in mansions with nary a budget fixture in sight. In court papers, Susan said Alex's lifestyle when his father was alive included vacationing with Mark at his lavish beach home, cruising on Mark's yacht, driving in Mark's fleet of luxury cars, and attending events of extraordinary prestige, lavishness, and extravagance. As Susan saw it, Mark had hired the trustees to maintain Alex's lifestyle, not downgrade it. "These three guys are employees, sycophants, and dictators," Susan said to a reporter in 2003. Susan wants Alex to have the life his father intended for him. Her lawyer, the late Hillel Chodos, said in a separate interview, "They loathe Susan. She has criticized them. They don't like to be criticized." As the court fights exploded, Alex was thrust into an unwanted spotlight, dubbed America's richest teenager. At the heart of the lawsuits was the mountain, which Mark had wanted preserved for his son. The property cost around $250,000 a year to maintain by 2020, but maintenance was never a question. The trustees saw its potential as a development site. In 2004, the trustees sold the mountain in a no-cash deal to Charles Chip Dickens, an Atlanta businessman, lending Dickens the money to buy the mountain, and the mountain was lost. When Alex turned 18 in December 2009, he hired his own lawyers and launched his own lawsuit to have the trustees removed. In 2013, he won, mainly because the trustees had botched the mountain sale so badly. Judge Mitchell Beckloff ultimately ruled the trustees showed a gross breach of trust that borders on recklessness and resulted in significant damage to the trust. The trustees had lent money to Dickens, a man with no experience and no money, then sat back and did nothing as his company continually defaulted, according to a court ruling. The trust is now run by institutional trustees at Fiduciary International Trust of California. While Alex, now 30, declined to be interviewed, sources say he agreed with the actions his mother took. "Their interests have always been aligned," a legal source said. "Alex has been through so much. He just wants to be out of the spotlight," a source close to him said. "He is just not ready to talk." Alex is an independent producer and founder of Spacemaker Productions, who recently co-produced Armageddon Time, starring Anne Hathaway, Jeremy Strong, and Anthony Hopkins, which received a standing ovation at Cannes in May. "My son's privacy is uber important," says Susan. "He didn't ask for any of this." Next photos, top of the world. The mountain's asking price tumbled from $1 billion before it sold in foreclosure auction for $100,000 plus debt 4 years later. Susan and Mark Hughes with their son Alex in 1997, 3 years before Mark's death. Golden hour bloomed as we reached the mountain's top. Ribbons of colored light and jet contrails laced the sky, and a family of deer romped in the distance. My guide exhaled, less an aerobic heave, more a long sigh of relief. "Standing here makes it all worth it," said Susan Hughes. The mountain was Mark's dream, not hers, but she's ready to talk about her fight to keep it and her life with Hughes. "Did you see The Insider?" she asked, referring to the 1999 film, starring Al Pacino, about a tobacco industry whistleblower, and coincidentally based on a 1996 Vanity Fair article. "That's kind of how I felt for 13 years. Opening up today takes a lot out of me. It takes me back there." A drop of around 1,400 feet, and out beyond L.A. lies the Pacific. On the 4th of July, Susan says, you can see the fireworks displays of five different enclaves, including Malibu, Marina del Rey, and Encino. "I wanted to take Alex here after his father died to see the fireworks, but the trustees wouldn't give us the key." The key was in the hands of Conrad Klein, Mark's lawyer, and one of three literal gatekeepers, who died in 2019. The other trustees were senior Herbalife International exec Christopher Pear, who became acting CEO after Mark's death, and John Jack Reynolds, Mark's biological dad, who died in June 2021. Pear stepped down as CEO in 2001 after investors complained that Pear, Klein, and Reynolds, all executives as well as trustees, had conflicts of interest. Pear did not respond to requests for comment for this story. Herbalife was sold in 2002. "The devil had nothing on Klein," says Susan. "He became the dictator of my life." During the first decade of the dispute, Alex's lawyers said the trustees spent $22.6 million of the trust money on litigation, plus around $10 million as payment to themselves. While denying Susan's request for the smallest of things, some of Mark's clothing, his surfboard, furniture that reminded Alex of his father, according to Susan and to court documents. Alex's lawyer, Eric Rowan, also declined comment for this story. Susan had been the third of Mark's four wives and the mother of his only child. She was also his longest relationship. "When I met Mark, it was like this explosion," says Susan, who joined Herbalife in 1985, 5 years after Mark started it, and married him in 1987. "I had all these great ideas, and he had this marketing system, so it was like whoosh, it was perfect. We got it to $1 billion in 1997, and then I said, we did it, and he said, let's do another billion, and I said, not so much." In 1998, they divorced, and in 1999, Mark married Darcy Lapeer, a self-described actor, model, and rodeo barrel racer, whose past husbands included Hawaiian tropic mogul Ron Rice and actor Jean-Claude Van Damme. The next year, Mark was dead. Lapeer received around $34 million, according to reports. But Susan got to keep Mark himself. "The only thing the trustees granted without demanding the request come in writing," she says, and still keeps his ashes in an urn on a mantel in her Beverly Hills home, where years of framed Christmas photos of Mark, Susan, and Alex populate a wall. The couple first met at an L.A. restaurant. Mark had just flown in from New York. He was perfectly dressed with his hair, and he looked so handsome. His friends asked if I knew who he was, and I said, "Yeah, the maitre d', and I'm the rocket scientist." "Everyone was laughing," Susan said. "We were having so much fun, like it was all in slow-mo. We were like Ken and Barbie." They were both into health and nutrition. Mark was a marketing genius, and Susan had ideas about skin, hair, and fitness. For a time, they lived large, then sold their home to fund their legal battles against Big Pharma, which tried to wipe them out, Susan said. For a while, they lived in a rental on Benedict Canyon. Their landlord, according to Susan, was Max Baer Jr., who played Jethro Bodine on the Beverly Hillbillies and was a son of the heavyweight boxing champion. They married in Maui in September 1987 and renewed their vows each year. In places like Cabo San Lucas, Tahiti, the French Riviera, and Hawaii, it was a little like a fairy tale at first. Next photo, over the hill, a private cobblestone drive leads to a plot with 5,000 plants and more than 500 trees. But Herbalife had its ups and downs, and so did the marriage. Mark, a high school dropout, launched the company out of the trunk of his car in 1980. He said he was inspired to help people lose weight following the death of his mother, who had been addicted to diet pills. Inspiration may have also come from a now-shuttered CEDU school, a controversial system of reform schools for troubled teens like Mark, whose education included fundraising from strangers. Other former attendants, including Paris Hilton, who attended a CEDU school, have alleged disturbing and abusive forms of group therapy. According to reports, Pear's relationship with Hughes dated back to his own connection to the school. By 1984, Herbalife was a $500 million a year business. The next year, however, the FDA, the California AG's office, and the State Department of Health cited labeling and sales practice issues. There were also complaints about health and safety, as well as allegations the company was a pyramid scheme. But Herbalife continued its radical rise, and Mark and Susan had Alex in 1991. The family bought Gray Hall, an historic mansion where Douglas Fairbanks once lived, traveling by secret tunnel to the home he shared with Mary Pickford next door. The mansion was also a setting for Kris Kristofferson's home in the 1976 version of A Star is Born. Susan stopped accompanying Mark on travels with Alex in school. When Mark would return from a trip, recalls Susan, he'd be dead tired from the long flight. I'd say, "What are you doing?" And he'd say, "I just like walking around the house to see what I worked so hard for. This is what you give up your life for." By 1997, Herbalife had topped $1 billion in sales. That's when Mark and Susan bought the mountain, and Susan filed for divorce. The mountain didn't cause their problems, but it was emblematic of them. Instead of enjoying Gray Hall, Mark wanted to build a 50,000-square-foot Mediterranean villa atop the mountain, with a wildlife refuge, million-gallon pond, and tennis pavilion. For Susan, it was too much. "I didn't want to build a giant house. It's a beautiful piece of property, and there is nothing like it on the planet. But I was happy with the house we had. You can have enough without having to go further and higher and bigger," she said. "You can be satisfied." The divorce was finalized in 6 months, with Mark keeping 98% of the marital assets. "He was a nice guy, and I didn't want to fight with him over money," Susan said, though outlets reported she hired Anthony Pelicano, who was later convicted on separate wiretapping charges, as an investigator. "I didn't need three houses or a yacht or things. We ended as friends. They even lived together during the divorce, as Susan renovated her own $4 million fixer-upper, a beautiful 11,000-square-foot mansion with a pool and tennis courts in Beverly Hills, a few blocks from Gray Hall. It was another smart real estate investment worth around $20 million today. Susan leveraged the mortgage to pay for her mountain litigation, even if that meant she occasionally couldn't afford to repair things like ceiling leaks. From the start, Susan believed the co-trustees did not have Alex's interest at heart. 10 days after Mark's death, according to Susan, Klein sent Susan a letter demanding she use the word please when asking for something sentimental from the trust on behalf of Alex. Susan felt that Klein viewed her in sexist terms as a dumb, greedy ex-beauty queen who was jealous of the fourth wife's inheritance. She also says Klein's behavior wouldn't fly today. But Miss Petite USA was also a certified court reporter. "I lost 80 hours a week of litigation to get Mark's golf clubs," she said, "pretty trivial stuff, while they were stealing a mountaintop or using Herbalife as their candy store." Even LaPierre, Hughes' fourth wife, says Alex and Susan were surrounded by sharks. "Mark knew how to tame them. He said it was like going to nursery school, but when he passed, everything was off." The trustees, she says, turned their aggression onto little Alex and Susan, and notes she's thankful the mother and son have finally won it back. After Susan asked the trust for the Aubusson pillows, the request made it into media reports. The trustees, she said, couldn't believe that a child asked for couch pillows. "They blew it up to discredit me," Susan said. Susan, who had partly been raised in a Brooklyn orphanage and with foster parents, taken from her parents when she was 7 months old, says she felt very alone throughout the experience. No family, no friends. Next photo, in residence. Susan spent years embroiled in legal battles with her ex-husband's estate in an effort to protect their son's assets. As they paraded around on stages around the world, Hotel du Cap Hydrogue in Cannes, rented out by Herbalife, having Elton John play for them in the company, I was trying to get my son's Batman bedsheets from them. We asked for Mark's favorite T-shirt. They said, "Sue us," she said, adding that she had to file lawsuits to force the trust to pay the already agreed-upon $10,000 a month in child support. There's a lot of money. There's the company and the land, and all they have to do, Susan's voice dropped below a whisper, is just F over one little boy. It gets very tempting. Once, when Susan asked for $160,000 to pay for a two-month summer rental in Malibu for herself and Alex, the trustees instead granted her $80,000 for 1 month. Not long after, Pear called to invite Susan and Alex, then 13, to a King Tut exhibit that night with his own son, who was 9. It was the first time Pear and Susan had spoken in 3 years. When Susan asked Pear why the trust wouldn't pay for the summer rental, Pear said they could if she would be nice to him. "You know, everyone always had a thing for you," she says Pear told her. "You were one of the most beautiful, unattainable women in the world. Here's my home telephone number, and call me when you're ready to give me what I want." Susan took Alex to the King Tut exhibit herself. Pear was there and approached her, according to Susan. Alex was just a few feet away, as she recalls, when Pear leaned in and allegedly said, "I'll get you on your knees eventually. I'm going to F you one way or the other." Susan says that happened in June 2005. By August, she filed a lawsuit alleging emotional distress and sexual harassment. While Pear did not respond to Vanity Fair, at the time he denied the allegations. "The suit is totally without merit, and I'm deeply offended and saddened she would resort to such tactics." Pear won dismissal of the suit. The courts concluded that the emotional distress Susan claimed to suffer wasn't severe enough, but they did acknowledge conduct attributed to Pear was grossly inappropriate. At the time, Klein's wife, Joan Dempsey Klein, was an esteemed and powerful justice on the California Appeals Court, a fifth-generation Californian who became the state's first female presiding justice. She retired at age 90 in 2014 and died 6 years later in December 2020. And although Judge Klein had nothing to do with this case, from Susan's perspective, that gave him an advantage in court. The trustees had set up MH Holdings II, LLC, MH2, in 2003, an entity that held the mountain, then known as Tower Grove, as an asset of the trust, managed by Klein. That year, after the court denied the trustees indemnification in a quest to develop the property themselves, MH2 leased Tower Grove to Chip Dickens for $0 and loaned him $1.5 million to complete a tract map with an option to buy the mountain. That was the trustees' first loan to Dickens. Though Dickens completed the tract map, he could not come up with the money to buy the mountain, so the trustees lent him another $23.75 million with no money down, even though another buyer had offered $25.75 million in cash for the mountain. That was the trustees' second loan to Dickens. In court papers, the trustees said that Susan signed off on the deal, receiving $250,000 herself. But Susan told Vanity Fair she never gave her approval and thought the $250,000 payment was for the tract map. In 2006, the trust loaned an entity operated by Dickens another $12 million for construction, the trust's third loan to Dickens, but stopped the disbursements at $10.6 million. As time went on, it seemed to Susan that Dickens was a proxy developer for Klein. In the ensuing years, Dickens defaulted on the loans and struggled to hang on to the mountain. His entity, Tower Park Properties, filed for bankruptcy in 2008. Dickens' company came out of bankruptcy in 2010, still owning the mountain. The trustees then loaned one of his entities another $7 million, a fourth loan. More than $5.5 million of that loan was dispersed. But by then, Alex had filed his own petition to remove the trustees. Next photo, going, going, gone. Chip Dickens owned the mountain before losing it in a foreclosure auction that he's now challenging. In court, Alex's lawyers asked Klein if he had done his due diligence and if he believed Dickens was good for the money. "Mr. Dickens? No. As far as I know, he's a poor man," Klein testified. Dickens himself testified that he had to make sure Klein was happy. "If I went against or disagreed with him, I was putting myself in jeopardy because my middle name is Default, and at any time he could have pulled the plug." In 2010, as the trustees turned off the loan spigot, Dickens teamed up with Victorino Noval, a Cuban-born convicted felon turned Hollywood producer. Noval's biography sounds straight out of Hollywood, too. His father had driven a truck filled with weapons to help the CIA's failed Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, and then drove into the gates of the Uruguayan embassy in Cuba to seek asylum before fleeing with his family to the U.S. By the late 1990s, Noval, then known as Victor Jesus Noval, had defrauded the U.S. government, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, of at least $60 million and spent 3 years in jail on mail fraud and tax evasion charges, and was ordered to pay $25 million in restitution. Noval's lawyer, Ronald Richards, whose ex-wife, Louise Linton, is now married to Stephen Mnuchin, says that Noval no longer owes restitution. He notes that it was Noval who brought Sheikh Khalid al-Jarrah al-Sabah, a Kuwaiti big shot, into the mountain's prospects. From 2010 to 2019, Khalid, a member of Kuwait's ruling family and the Minister of Defense, wired $163 million to Noval-linked bank accounts, according to court papers. Noval further raised the mountain's profile by throwing star-studded parties. Online, he bragged that his charity, the now-defunct Victorino Noval Foundation, boasted $1.2 billion in assets. Richards, his lawyer, later told me that Noval had factored the estimated value of the mountain, $1 billion, into the charity's assets. These days, Noval, who declined to comment to Vanity Fair, is still living large. He has a following of 25,200 on his verified Instagram, where he describes himself as a movie producer and investor based in Beverly Hills. In 2014, the mountain had one of its first galas, hosted by Charlize Theron, to benefit her Africa Outreach project. But it was a disaster, with bad food, party crashers, and malfunctioning porta-potties, according to reports. Another charity event, hosted by Rihanna that December, did better, drawing celebs like Salma Hayek, Jimmy Kimmel, Kim Kardashian, and Brad Pitt, who had reportedly looked at the property back in 2002. In 2015, Dickens and Noval briefly floated the mountain for $1.41 billion, although there was no official listing, according to sources with knowledge. But 3 years later, they listed it at that price with celebrity broker Aaron Kerman, who declined to speak with Vanity Fair. The property instantly drew interest from billionaires, including Jeff Bezos, and coincidentally Mohammed bin Salman, accused of ordering the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, employed by Bezos at the Washington Post. Despite the buzz, there were no bids. The property was large, but only zoned for six homes, none of which existed. By February 2019, the asking price had dropped to $650 million. Still no bites. Developer Scott Gillen submitted a $400 million bid, which was rejected. When reached by Vanity Fair, Gillen said the smoke and mirror days of developers having no skin in the game are over. By 2013, Klein and the other two trustees were gone, and the new institutional trustee wanted Dickens and Noval to pay the trust what they owed. At this point, the mountain was owned by Secured Capital Partners, which was controlled by Noval's son, Victor Franco Noval. A month earlier, in July, Secured Capital had tried and failed to declare Chapter 11 bankruptcy. That led the trust to push for a foreclosure auction to force a sale. SCP then transferred ownership back to Tower Park Properties, where Victorino Noval and Dickens were majority owners. Richards, Noval's lawyer, told Vanity Fair, "When the foreclosure auction was set for August 2019, the Mark Hughes Family Trust pounced, buying it back for $100,000 plus $200 million in debt. The trust once again owned the mountain with no limitations on selling it," Susan's lawyer, Lisa McCurdy, explained to Vanity Fair. McCurdy was also part of Alex's legal team that successfully petitioned the court to remove the trustees. But the ex-trustees had caused serious damage. The beneficiary and current trustee believe the former trustees are responsible for hundreds of millions in damage to the trust, McCurdy said. The trust job is to preserve assets, not squander them. In April, Dickens' company filed a challenge to the validity of the foreclosure auction. Richards, Noval's lawyer, concurred. The borrower contended that no money was owed. If a creditor elects to do non-judicial foreclosure, there is no recourse against the borrower. So when the Hughes Trust foreclosed on the property, any debt owed by Tower Properties went to zero, as there is an anti-deficiency statute in California. Susan was at the auction back in August 2019. It was not widely attended, just regular auction-goers in lawn chairs behind a fountain at an outdoor plaza in Pomona, according to reports. When a Los Angeles Times reporter approached Susan, clad in a pinstripe suit and sunglasses, and asked who she was, she said she was no one, and that she was just stopping by while on a walk. "When the trust won the sale, she was in tears. I went behind a tree to cry," Susan told me. Meanwhile, on September 13, 2019, around a week before the foreclosure auction, Khalid filed a lawsuit in California claiming that Noval and his associates had misused the $163 million. Instead of funding the mountain, the lawsuit claimed, the money fueled Noval's lavish and extravagant lifestyle, which included the purchase of Beverly Hills mansions, a yacht, a jet, a Lamborghini, and $40,000 worth of a prizefighter's memorabilia. Khalid was seeking close to $500 million in damages, alleging that he would have at least doubled his investment if the mountain had actually been developed. Noval denied the claims and maintained his innocence through his lawyer, Richards. Khalid's L.A.-based lawyer, Bobby Samini, declined comment. Back in Kuwait, anti-corruption prosecutors had been investigating the disappearance of billions of dollars from Kuwaiti state coffers. Khalid's California lawsuit provided them with a picture of what happened to some of the money. Investigators were able to trace close to $1 billion that passed through London bank accounts to Lebanon, Bahrain, France, and California. Prosecutors could see transfers to other accounts, but couldn't access the accounts to learn more. "It was the dumbest thing he could have done," an anti-corruption source told Vanity Fair. "It was so interesting and clear." In March 2021, Khalid was arrested and jailed in Kuwait, for his alleged role in a $790 million corruption scandal known as the Military Fund case, along with former Prime Minister Sheikh Jaber al-Mubarak al-Sabah and other high officials. Khalid, in his defense, said the payments to Naval-controlled California bank accounts were made in the interest of national security. He also said the payments were made with the knowledge and consent of the emir, who by then was dead. Now that the mountain was back with the trust, run by an institutional trustee of Alex's choosing, Alex and Susan considered their options. By May 2020, the trust had tapped a top New York broker, Doug Harmon, to bring the mountain back to market. "It's a magical masterpiece, the Mona Lisa of available land sites," Harmon told me at the time. Harmon has sold some of the country's most valuable commercial properties, including the GM building in New York, the Willis Tower in Chicago, and the Bank of America Center of San Francisco. But the listing never stood a chance. First came rumblings from Dickens, challenging the foreclosure, and Khalid's legal situations in Kuwait and California had the unintended consequence of waking another sleeping giant. In July 2020, the Justice Department filed 7 lawsuits seeking the forfeiture of prized California real estate, including the mountain. The feds, following FBI and IRS investigations, alleged that former high-level officials in Kuwait's Ministry of Defense had embezzled more than $104 million from Kuwaiti state coffers. The money, the feds claimed, moved from Kuwait to London to California bank accounts controlled by Naval's son. Khalid was not named in the suits, but Victorina Naval was. The government settled the case against the mountain on September 28, 2020, a Justice Department spokesman says, adding that the feds stayed the other cases seeking forfeiture of other assets allegedly bought with Kuwaiti money. Ever since 9/11, when Congress tightened anti-money laundering laws in banking under the Patriot Act, unsavory characters from around the world, including public officials, have found a workaround by investing stolen money in real estate, including in the U.S. Under President Biden, such corruption has finally been acknowledged as a national security threat because it undermines democracy while strengthening autocracies. Just look at Russia. The Kuwaiti asset forfeiture case is significant because it is another example of how the U.S. will assist foreign countries, says a former federal prosecutor with extensive kleptocracy experience and knowledge of the mountain case. "It's important for countries to know that their corrupt politicians won't be able to come to the U.S. and buy toys and invest in properties and retire here." In March this year, Khalid was released from jail and acquitted, devastating Kuwait's anti-corruption activist. But in May, the Justice Department filed a new consolidated asset forfeiture case against 3 unnamed high-ranking Kuwaiti officials, along with Victorino Noval, Victor Franco Noval, Secured Capital Partners, and others connected to the other California assets. The U.S. government is seeking forfeiture of any assets purchased with stolen Kuwait money. There is no evidence that the Novals had any knowledge that Mr. Sabah had used stolen Kuwait funds for any monies he sent to the U.S., Richards said. And as for the $163 million Khalid wired to Noval-controlled bank accounts, it was used in the mountain. The mountain remains, even as Dickens and Noval continue to challenge the foreclosure auction in court. Susan doesn't seem too worried. "There are no holds on the mountain now," Susan says. "I feel more safe and have more peace, but you can never get back those 13 years. Susan says Alex has no big plans for the mountain at the moment. She would like to put in a pond, build a gazebo. This winter she planted geraniums, but deer ate them. The mountain, she says, has had a lot of commotion, and it's resting now. It's beautiful and green. I might put it with a conservatory and make it a park. That's not out of the question. Now, here's the Proust Questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Alfre Woodard, the award-winning actor and activist on Jackknife Jumps, Sailing, and Waving the Baton at the L.A. Phil. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Under sail somewhere with my children, Mavis and Duncan, and my husband, Roderick, with no agenda. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I'm all pieced out about it. Which living person do you most despise? I despise the actions of so many who are willfully endangering the lives of Americans they fear. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Can I ask you a question? What is your greatest regret? I laughed at a vulnerable classmate's socks in fourth grade. It hurt and surprised her. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My hilarious, exceptional, irreverent, and kind children. When and where were you happiest? Between action and cut. What is your greatest fear? Rats. Which living person do you most admire? My dear friend Eve Plotkin, supervising attorney at the New York Legal Aid Society, head of the family law unit for 25 years. What do you consider your greatest achievement? A jackknife jump into a full front split, repeatedly. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Inefficiency? Whiners? What is your greatest extravagance? Traveling well. What is your favorite journey? To the unfamiliar, then returning because of the fellowship formed. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Selflessness. Who are your favorite writers? Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez. On what occasion do you lie? When I have nothing left to give, but people don't accept that. Which talent would you most like to have? Dancing a la Judith Jameson. What is your current state of mind? Reaching toward balanced. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'd like to be 6 feet tall. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I would not come back. What is your most treasured possession? Whenever I've had one, I've lost it. What is your motto? No one surrenders here. What is it that you most dislike? Racist actions, racist policies, unexamined racist thought. Where would you like to live? New Zealand, pulled a little closer. What is your most marked characteristic? The timbre of my voice. What do you most value in your friends? Humor. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Janie Crawford from Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. Who are your heroes in real life? Marion Wright Edelman, Grasa Machel, Serena Williams. How would you like to die? Unaware. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? The Maestro for the L.A. Philharmonic at Disney Hall. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Alfre Woodard. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.